once again say, if you have anything that you would like to share about Miss Yvonne, for those of you who did get to know her, please, by all means, send me a message and let me know. All right, well, let's do just a little bit of review. I bet you all know what slide I'm going to show you here at the very start of class, which is the way that we've analyzed the book of Romans. For those of you visiting or for latecomers into the class, this organization is following a pattern of certain summary statements in which Luke talks to us about the progress of the gospel. And that's really how we've been studying the book. Not so much as a story of the apostles, but as the story of the gospel and the spread of the gospel itself. We're in the final section here, as you can see, where the storyline pivots for Paul to make his way to Rome. At first, it's not clear how he's going to get there. But we are learning more and more about how it's going to turn out that the Apostle Paul gets to actually go and preach in the city of Rome itself. So where we ended class on Sunday was with Paul's defense before the Roman governor, whose name is Felix. And we talked about him a little bit. As you may recall, what happens is Paul's case is transferred from the city of Jerusalem up to the city of Caesarea on the coast, Caesarea Maritima, because there was a plot against Paul, and they needed to transfer him out of there where the main Roman garrison is in Caesarea, so they have, you might say, maximum security. So that's where Paul goes, and that's where he makes his defense in front of the governor, who we talked about a little bit, who is a real scoundrel by all accounts, Jewish and Roman, among the ancient historians, whose name was Felix. And you'll notice that at the end of chapter 24, it says that he kept Paul around for 2 years. That's what it says in verse 27. And he was keeping Paul around because he hoped what would happen. Yeah, he'd get money, he'd get a payoff, he'd get a bribe, which tells you that must have been common practice for him, as it often is all through points in history. Well, because he was such a rotten governor and did such a bad job, the Romans eventually yanked him out of there and put in his successor, who is named for us in verse 27 of chapter 24. What's his successor's name? Festus, Porcius Festus. Now, there is a generation in this auditorium that as soon as you hear the name Festus, this is what pops into your mind right here. That guy right there. Now, some of you are staring at that, and you have no idea why some of us are so happy. That's because you've got a miserable life, and you were just born at a terrible time in life, and you need to go home and look up on TV Land or whatever channel it is and find Gunsmoke and start watching Gunsmoke, one of the great TV shows of all time. In any event, it's not this Festus. The problem is that's the best I can do for a picture, because the real guy didn't last very long. So we're just going to have to put picture not on file for this guy. Looking around on the internet, I did find a coin that he had minted in honor of Caesar, but no picture of him himself. I mean, I suppose I could have just inserted any old marble sculpture from the antiquity and said, hey, there's Festus right there. But anyhow, and we don't even really know much about him. I mean, really, most of the information we have about him comes from two sources, Josephus and the book of Acts, which is used by historians, of course, because of its detail. Josephus has a pretty favorable opinion of Festus, certainly compared to Felix, that he tried to rein in the extremists. You remember back when Paul was accosted in the temple, and the commander went and caught him, and he said, aren't you one of the Egyptian who was the ringleader of the assassins? All right, well, though we're talking about those, the knife guys, the dagger guys, the Sicarii. They were the extremists who would go through and basically murder fellow Jews who were too friendly to Rome. Festus, for example, cracked down on those guys. He apparently didn't last very long, though, in office. He died in office. And although there's some debate as to what year he died, it seems as if he died in about the year 61. So that gives us, sometimes some of you all ask for, like, you know, chronology. That gives us a ballpark as to when these events here are taking place. All right, so we're going to do 25 and 26 together tonight. Verse 1 of chapter 25 says, "Now 3 days after Festus had arrived in the province, he went up to Jerusalem from Caesarea. And the chief priests and principal men of the Jews laid out their case against Paul, and they urged him, asking as a favor against Paul that he summon him to Jerusalem." And why do they want to get Paul back to Jerusalem? Yeah, it's like an old Western, right? They're going to lay an ambush, and they're going to try to murder him while he is in transit. And so, in verse 4, Festus replied that Paul was being kept at Caesarea, and he himself intended to go there shortly. So he's not going to go in for their request in this plot. However, verse 5, "So he said, let the men of authority among you go down with me, and if there's anything wrong about the man, let them bring charges against him. After he stayed among them not more than 8 or 10 days, he went down to Caesarea and the next day took his seat on the tribunal and ordered Paul to be brought. When he arrived, the Jews who'd come down from Jerusalem stood around him bringing many and serious charges against him that they could not prove." Now, we've already seen this before, right? And when their hired gun Tertullus tried to bring the case against Paul before Felix, it failed miserably. And the same thing is true here, because all of their accusations against Paul are demonstrably false. He did not stir up a riot. He did not bring a Gentile into the forbidden area of the temple. He was doing exactly the opposite. He was paying alms for Jews and following Jewish custom. Verse 8, "Paul argued in his defense, 'Neither against the law of the Jews, nor against the temple, nor against Caesar have I committed any offense.'" And you remember that was the triad of charges that they had leveled against him. I suppose the only thing new here that Paul mentions is "nor against Caesar." And what that may suggest is that the tactics of the enemies are changing and morphing a little bit. If we can't get Paul in trouble because of the temple and the law and the Jewish people, well, let's stir up charges against the Romans, you know, that he's disrespectful of the Romans. And what should that remind us of as readers of Luke and Acts? Yeah, it's just the very same thing with Jesus, right? When the Jews convicted Jesus, they convicted him of blasphemy. But in order to get Jesus murdered, what did they have to get him convicted of? Yeah, you know, treason, sedition, you know, raising up, instigating a rebellion against Caesar. So very same kind of thing going on here. Yeah, Mickey? Yeah. Right. Yeah. Well, you know, Mickey's making a good point that it just seems so odd that people are supposed to follow principles like "you shall not bear false witness." The tragedy is, though, and you know, a lot of this is my fault. In the 5+ years that I've been here, we have not studied the Old Testament historical books. And I'm hoping maybe next year to find at least one quarter where we can do something to get us in those sections of the Old Testament. But if you're familiar either with the later history of Israel or some of the prophets, it's more common than not that, for example, prophets end up getting persecuted. And Jesus can even say, "Which of the prophets did your fathers not murder?" You know? And a lot of times in doing that, they were raising false charges against God's spokesman. So there's a sense in which what you say is absolutely understandable. Like, how could these people just flat out lie, you know? But on the other hand, if you just look at the big picture of the Bible, it's unfortunate that you can, you know, you can see that happen or not. And it's always a sign of judgment when people are to that point. Yeah.
I mean, that's beyond what I can understand. A true Jew or a true follower of the law could do.
Well, I wish I could find some way to say, yeah, you know, you're right, Mickey. This was just a rare exception. But, I mean, you do kind of see this thing replay itself, you know, over and over again. And, you know, in one way or another, if we're not trying to serve the Lord and somebody's calling us out on it, we want to do whatever we can to stop that, you know. So in a sense, that's kind of what's going on here. Justin and then Leanne.
I was just wondering, I had a question. It says they could not prove these things, right? What kind of proof, like in that culture back then, was needed to be able to make somebody guilty?
Or yeah, at the mouth of... Right. Yeah, mouth of two or three witnesses would be like the standard proof. Well, that's right. Remember, we made the point, they've got false witnesses just like there were against Jesus. Yeah. And that's kind of Mickey's point. I mean, it's deliberate telling lies to get somebody killed. Yeah. Yeah.
I think the idea is there's no corroboration. Like, even in the case of Jesus, remember,
the testimony of the false witnesses was falling apart. Yeah. So I think that'd be the way to look at it. Yeah.
I think it just takes a handful of convincing people, and then a mob mentality can take over.
Right. Well, I mean, Leanne's making the point. It is easy for us, I think, to sit here and say, you know, how could this happen? And yet, you know, honestly, I was making the point about Bible history. I mean, just human history. I mean, it doesn't take us too many years distance to see millions of people murdered on the basis of lies, but because people's minds are so twisted and distorted by hate and prejudice, it's pretty easy to justify just about anything, you know. So anyhow, let's move on back here. I mean, those are all very poignant comments for sure. Just hard to understand, I think. Certainly as people trying to follow Jesus, hard to understand. Now, here's the problem. Look at verse 9. What does Festus say and why? First of all, what does he say? Hey, Paul, do you want to go back to Jerusalem? And why does he say it? Wishing to do the Jews a favor. And that should draw your attention back up to verse 27 of the previous chapter. Felix left Paul in prison desiring to do what? Same thing. And at this point, what does Paul clearly get? What does he understand? Is he going to get a fair shake here? No. Because you've got another governor who is going to be tempted for political purposes to give the Jews what they want. And Paul knows what that's going to mean. And so, in verse 10, Paul said, I'm standing before Caesar's tribunal, where I ought to be tried. To the Jews, I have done no wrong, as you yourself know very well. If then I am a wrongdoer and have committed anything for which I deserve to die, I do not seek to escape death. But if there's nothing to their charges against me, no one can give me up to them. And then he makes the famous appeal, I appeal to Caesar, a right that he had as a Roman citizen to invoke appeal to Caesar. Paul knows if I'm going to get any kind of justice at all, it's not going to be in this region with these people manipulating the Roman governors. I'm just going to have to go to Rome itself. And so Festus confers and says, to Caesar you have appealed, to Caesar you shall go. And now we start to get an inkling of how it is that what we read in chapter 19 is actually going to happen. Remember in chapter 19, in the Spirit, Paul said, I'm going to go to Jerusalem and then I'm going to go to Rome. But there have been a lot of twists and turns already between then and now. In fact, at one point he thought I might even die in Jerusalem. But now it turns out he is going to go to Rome, although not probably in the way that he had envisioned. Now he's going to go as a prisoner appealing his case. Yeah, Miss Irma? Irma's asking if Festus knew Paul was a Roman citizen. My guess is that Felix had gotten him up to speed about the case.
Kind of let the Jews know he was doing what they wanted,
yeah.
Knowing that it couldn't be anyway. Because he was a Roman citizen.
Now, see, here's what I like about Miss Irma. She's a cup half full kind of person. So I'm thinking Festus is just another craven politician trying to keep power and willing to sell Paul down the road. She's saying Festus knew that Paul wasn't going to go with this, and he knew he was a Roman citizen, so he actually knew by making this offer, it ended up getting Paul to Rome. Is that basically what you're saying? Yeah. Now, see, we need more people. I mean, I think you're hopelessly naive, or I'll just tell you. No, but I mean, we need more people. Like, Mr., I like that. No, it could be. It could be. I hadn't thought about it from that angle before, but I can't disprove you for sure. So, yeah. Certainly, that's what ends up happening regardless. Yeah, Tommy?
The Jew didn't have the authority to appeal to Caesar?
If he was a Roman citizen. Yes, as a Roman citizen, that kind of trumps everything. And again, we kind of talked about this, remember, when we were in chapter 16 and Paul was beaten at Philippi and they didn't realize he was a Roman citizen. We've made the point a couple of times since then that, you know, Roman citizenship just had a lot more gravitas, a lot more cachet to it than American citizen probably does in our mind. If you were, it was difficult. I mean, you had to, in the case of Paul, he was born a Roman citizen. In the case of his father, probably his father had to have done some great, noble, heroic service for the empire to even be given it, assuming that that's how it happened. So yeah, it's a big deal. And yes, even if he was a Jew, if he was a Roman citizen, that just carried a lot more punch. And it's hard, again, for us probably to wrap our minds around that. All right, let's move on here now. Verse 13. When some days had passed, who shows up? Agrippa the king and Bernice arrived at Caesarea and greeted Festus. So this is Herod Agrippa the second. So here is the Herodian family tree. So the granddaddy of them all at the top of the heap here is Herod the Great, the guy who ordered the slaughter of babies in Bethlehem to have Jesus murdered. He had four sons. The son that we know most about is Herod Antipas. Herod Antipas is the guy who had John the Baptist executed and who was who presided over one of the hearings of Jesus. And by the way, that's kind of another one of these parallels here, right? Remember in the case of Jesus' trial, he's tried before the Jews and the Sanhedrin and the priest, and then before a Roman governor and a Herod and the governor. Well, guess how Paul's hearings are going to go? He's going to be tried before the Jewish priest and Sanhedrin, and then he's tried before a governor, Felix, and now a Herod and a Roman governor. So very, Luke is intentionally telling the story so that we draw these parallels showing us that a disciple is like his master, right? So that's Herod Antipas, all right? Then you come down to the next level here, and you've got Herod Agrippa the First. This is the guy we met, the unsavory character back in Acts 12, who had James the son of Zebedee executed and intended to do the same to whom else? Yeah, he was going to have Peter killed, but Peter escapes. And then Luke narrates the very grisly and gruesome death of Herod Agrippa the First. And now you've got Herod Agrippa the Second. Now that's quite a family tree, right, to be from here. I mean, it's just basically murderous tyrants here at every level. Now, I don't know a whole lot about Herod Agrippa the Second. It does seem like he probably, I know he spent a lot of time in Rome and ingratiated himself to the Roman court. And I think he was probably a much smoother operator, political manipulator, rather than just a thuggish tyrant, probably is my guess, than the other guy. See, I'm trying to be nice too here, okay? So he wasn't nearly as bad a despot as all the other Herods were. This Bernice who's mentioned here, I've always thought when I was a kid it was his wife. It's actually his sister. Although she had a pretty checkered past herself, and some of the ancients believed that they had an inappropriate relationship. And this chart I got because it was the easiest one to read in an auditorium. This chart actually calls her the wife, quote unquote. I think it would be better to say the sister, quote unquote. And they were, in fact, sister, and depending on if you were reading the first century edition of the National Enquirer, then maybe something more than that. I don't know. So that's who this is. The reason I wanted to put this up here is to show you that the presence of a Herod, generally speaking, is bad news in the Bible. In this case, though, it's more complicated. It's more nuanced and subtle than that, for sure. So this is kind of like a state visit. You know, recently we had a state visit. The French or Canadian, one or the other. It's all the same. They were in town one time, and so, you know, they put on lavish banquets and everything else. So you're going to see kind of that kind of pomp and circumstance here in just a bit. So we're in 25:13. Now, when some days had passed, Agrippa the king and Bernice arrived at Caesarea and greeted Festus. And as they stayed there many days, Festus laid Paul's case before the king, saying, "There's a man left prisoner by Felix. And when I was at Jerusalem, the chief priests and the elders of the Jews laid out their case against him, asking for a sentence of condemnation against him. I answered them that it was not the custom of the Romans to give up anyone before the accused met the accusers face to face." It's a principle that just came right on down through English common law in our country. "And had opportunity to make his defense concerning the charge laid against him. So when they came together here, I made no delay, but on the next day took my seat on the tribunal and ordered the man to be brought. When the accusers stood up, they brought no charge in his case of such evils as I supposed. Rather," and then how does he characterize the dispute?
Disagreement.
Disagreements about what?
Religious.
Yeah, this is some inner Jewish debate going on. Doesn't have anything to do with us. And as I've told you before, that's a key issue in the book, because Rome had given official legal recognition to Judaism. If the Jews can convince the Romans that this Christian sect is this new illegal offshoot, then they can get Christians in trouble. And that's why Paul, in his defenses, always makes the point, look, this is not some new novel religion. I am the one who's truly faithful to the religion of the fathers here. All right. So, verse 19, "Rather they had certain points of dispute with him about their own religion and about a certain Jesus who was dead, but whom Paul asserted to be alive. Being at a loss how to investigate these questions," and you would have to imagine, right, your typical pagan bureaucrat just new to town would be absolutely dumbfounded at this argument that's going on here, "I asked whether he wanted to go to Jerusalem and to be tried there regarding them." He, of course, leaves out to do the Jews a favor, but hey, he's a politician. "But when Paul had appealed to be kept in custody for the decision of the emperor, I ordered him to be held until I could send him to Caesar," because, you know, you've got to work out shipping and travel plans and so forth. "Then Agrippa said to Festus, 'I'd like to hear the man myself.' 'Tomorrow,' he said, 'he, you will hear him.' So on the next day," so now just imagine every, you know, sword and sandal movie epic you've ever seen where there's something in the royal court. Just imagine all the pomp and circumstance you can picture here. "So on the next day, Agrippa and Bernice came with great pomp, and they entered the audience hall with the military tribunes and the prominent men of the city. Then, at the command of Festus, Paul was brought in." And you have to imagine there was such a sharp contrast between what Paul looked like and what everybody else decked out in their finest regalia looked like in this hall. Verse 24, "And Festus said, 'King Agrippa and all who are present with us, you see this man about whom the whole Jewish people petitioned me, both in Jerusalem and here, shouting that he ought not to live any longer. But I found that he had done nothing deserving of death.'" Does that sound familiar? It's exactly what Pilate said about Jesus, right? And again, this is a constant refrain we want to see here in Luke and Acts. "And as he himself appealed to Caesar, I decided to go ahead and send him. But I have nothing definite to write to my lord about him. Therefore, I've brought him before you all, and especially before you, King Agrippa." Why especially before King Agrippa? What would Agrippa know that? Yeah, because he's quasi-Jewish, right? He's the king of the Jews. So he's supposed to know. And as we're going to see, according to Paul, he does know his stuff. All right? "So, especially before you, King Agrippa, so that after we've examined him, I may have something to write. For it seems to me unreasonable in sending a prisoner not to indicate the charges against him." Yeah, exactly. You know, that's kind of the point here. "So," Agrippa said to Paul, you have permission to speak for yourself. Then Paul stretched out his hand, sort of a gesture that was common in ancient rhetoric, and made his defense. I consider myself fortunate that it is before you, King Agrippa, I'm going to make my defense today against all the accusations of the Jews, especially because you are familiar with all the customs and controversies of the Jews. Therefore, I beg you to listen to me patiently. My manner of life from my youth, spent from the beginning among my own nation and in Jerusalem, is known by all the Jews. They've known for a long time, if they are willing to testify, that according to the strictest party of our religion, I've lived as a Pharisee. And now I stand here on trial because of my hope in the promise made by God to our fathers, to which our 12 tribes hope to attain as they earnestly worship night and day. And for this hope I'm accused by Jews, O king. Why is it thought incredible by any of you? And you can just imagine at this point, Paul, you know, putting the spotlight on all the Jews who are present there. Why is it thought incredible by any of you that God raises the dead? You're supposed to believe in the God who can do such things. I myself was convinced that I ought to do many things in opposing the name of Jesus of Nazareth. And I did so in Jerusalem. I not only locked up many of the saints in prison after receiving authority from the chief priests, but when they were put to death, I cast my vote against them. And I punished them often in all the synagogues and tried to make them blaspheme. And in raging fury against them, I persecuted them even to foreign cities. Now, how many times, including this account, have we read the conversion of Saul of Tarsus in the book of Acts? Including this account. There, that's right, exactly right. So Acts 9 in real time. Then in Acts 22, when he was accosted by the mob, he did it right there on the spot, and now here. There's one other conversion story that's been told three times in Acts. Do you know which one it is? It's told in Acts 10, Acts 11, and Acts 15. Cornelius, exactly right. Now, the good guesser would think, two conversion stories told three times. I wonder what they have in common. So let's continue reading here. Verse 12, in this connection I journeyed to Damascus with the authority and the commission of the chief priests. At midday, O king, I saw on the way a light from heaven brighter than the sun. So it's not like he saw the sun and confused it. He clearly distinguishes the two. That shone around me and those who journeyed with me. And when we all fall into the ground, I heard a voice saying to me in, now this is a new detail, right? I don't think we've heard this detail before. What voice, what language does Paul say the voice spoke to him in? Yeah, the Hebrew Aramaic language, exactly. Saul, Saul, why are you persecuting me? It is hard for you to kick against the goads or the pricks. Y'all know what that's talking about, right? It's the stick the shepherd uses with a point on the end of it, or maybe a nail driven through it, that when the big beasts of burden decide they don't want to go, you just poke them in the back of the heel. And that's, you know, a tender spot. It's tender, I mean, tender on anybody, but especially on a work animal, and it makes them go. And only the most incredibly stubborn animal, instead of going, would start kicking back, because that's doing more harm to them. So that's what the Lord says to him. You're kicking against the goads. And I said, verse 15, who are you, Lord? And the Lord said, I am Jesus whom you're persecuting. But rise and stand upon your feet, for I've appeared to you for this purpose, to appoint you as a servant. Now, I want you to really zone in on that word. We're going to make a big point about it here in a minute. A servant. And witness to the things in which you have seen me and to those in which I will appear to you, delivering you from your people and from the Gentiles to whom I'm sending you. The Gentiles to whom I'm sending you. What are the two conversion stories told three times? Cornelius, Saul. Do you remember in Acts 22, when Paul tells this story to the mob, they listened to him, do you remember? Until what point? He was sent to the Gentiles. Why do you think Luke has included these two conversion stories three times? What do they have in common? The mission to the Gentiles. Exactly right. There's one other thing we're going to notice at the very end of the book that happens three times in the book that's going to tie into this as well. Very good. All right, so notice he says in verse 18 that God has appointed him as a servant to open their eyes, verse 18, so that they may turn from darkness to light and from the power of Satan to God, that they may receive forgiveness of sins and a place among those who are sanctified by faith in me. Now, I want you to notice that what he says here is he's been appointed as a servant to bring light to people in darkness. I'm harping on this for a reason, okay? Therefore, verse 19, O King Agrippa, I was not disobedient to the heavenly vision, but declared first to those in Damascus, then in Jerusalem, and throughout all the region of Judea, and also to the Gentiles. There's your Reader's Digest condensed version of Acts 9 through, 20. That they should repent and turn to God, performing deeds in keeping with their repentance. For this reason, the Jews seized me in the temple and tried to kill me. Now notice, Paul is making a very specific allegation. According to Paul, why do the Jews want to kill him ultimately? Because of what? His mission to the Gentiles. And think about it. Remember, what is it that they accused him of doing in the temple? He brought a Gentile in. Paul says, I'll just tell you what this all boils down to. They don't like me because I've been preaching the gospel to Gentiles. And we know that's the case based on all that we've previously seen in the book. Verse 22, to this day I've had the help that comes from God, and so I stand here testifying both to small and great, saying nothing but what the prophets and Moses said would come to pass. At the end of Luke, Jesus says, everything written about me in the law and the prophets and the Psalms must be fulfilled. And now Luke is restating that, as Paul says it, that the Christ must suffer and that by being the first to rise from the dead, I thought other people rose from the dead. Here's the difference. Other people were resuscitated. Jesus is the first to rise in glorious life, life that can pass through walls, that kind of thing. That's the big difference here. And proclaim, now notice, what would he proclaim? In verse 23, light, both to our people and to the Gentiles. So Christ is proclaiming light. But remember, what did Paul say up in verse 16? What was he appointed to be and do? A servant to do what? To take people in darkness and give them light. All right, so here's the point about evangelism I want to draw from this here. In evangelism, we are extending the mission of Jesus. Why did Jesus come? To seek and to save the lost. Now, of course, in his death, he does that in a profoundly different way than any of us ever could. But in terms of seeking and reaching out to the lost, that was his mission, and it's what our mission is. Now, let me just get you to real quickly turn with me to a passage back in the book of Isaiah, okay? To Isaiah chapter 49. Just about everybody who's been a Christian for any length of time knows Isaiah 53, right? The servant. But that's actually the fourth of four songs in Isaiah. In Hebrew, they're poems or songs that are about the servant. And Isaiah 49 is the second one of these. Now, there's something interesting that goes on here in Isaiah 49. In Isaiah 49, in verse 3, Isaiah 49, 3, who does the Lord identify as the servant? In Isaiah 49, 3, Israel. He said to me, you are my servant Israel, in whom I will be glorified. And yet, notice in verse 6, he says, it is too light a thing that you should be my servant to raise up the tribes of Jacob and to bring back the preserved of Israel. I will make you as a what? A light for the nations that my salvation may reach the end of the earth. Here's something odd about this passage. God's servant is Israel, and yet Israel the servant is going to save Israel. And not just Israel, the nations as well. Now, how can that be? How can Israel the nation save Israel the nation and the Gentiles? Well, remember, the name Israel is not just the name of a nation, is it? It's the name of a person as well. And sometimes in the Bible, you have terms like this that can refer to one person or to many. Now, as it turns out, when you come to the New Testament, how is it that Israel the servant will save Israel and the nations? How is that, and in whom is that ultimately going to be fulfilled? Who is the ultimate servant? Jesus, yeah. But then here's the thing I want you to notice. Paul, here in Acts chapter 26, says in verse 16 that God has appointed him as a servant to be a light to the nations. So here is a chart that, you remember a couple quarters ago I taught a class on Israel, Jesus, and the church. That's the first bill, right? This chart summarizes that entire quarter. Now, I had a hard time drawing these greater than and less than things because I couldn't find a symbol, so I had to do it, and it looks terrible, right? Be quiet, Adelia. All right, yes, it does look terrible, all right? So, but here is the point. Actually, somebody who dares to crawl up in here, tell me what the point of that slide is. Okay, none of you are, I don't blame you. I'd be scared to climb up in here too. Yes, Dean, go ahead. That's exactly right. It's as if everything God intends for Israel to be is condensed down and concentrated in Jesus. He's the ultimate son, the ultimate servant, the ultimate shepherd, the ultimate sacrifice, the ultimate Passover, the ultimate temple. You just go on and on and on. Whatever it is, he is the ultimate. But then through Christ, as he brings people into himself, then we become the temple. We become the sheep. We become the servant. And that's the idea here. And so the point I want you to see here is by Paul saying, hey, you know that language about the servant that could be a person and a nation, but it's all fulfilled in Christ? Well, now it's being re-expanded. It's been concentrated down and now re-expanded out. And it's being re-expanded out in the church. And just about every concept, son of God, servant, etc., you can filter through this chart and make sense of how the Old Testament relates Israel in the church. All right, well, we got to hurry because we got to get to the good stuff here. All right, so go back over here to Acts chapter 26. Verse 24. As soon as Paul brings up the resurrection of Christ, what does Festus say? You're out of your mind because as a Gentile, pagan, he doesn't believe in the resurrection. Verse 25, Paul said, I am not out of my mind, most excellent Festus, but I am speaking true and rational words. Your Bible probably says something a little different. For the king knows about these things, and to him I speak boldly. For I am persuaded that none of these things has escaped his notice, for this has not been done in a corner. King Agrippa, do you believe the prophets? Sorry to make Vicky stand in for King Agrippa here, but what I'm trying to communicate is Paul started this thing on trial, and it ends up with Agrippa on trial. Because now right in front of everybody, Paul calls him out. And he says, King Agrippa, do you believe the prophets? I know that you do. I know you do. Verse 28, Agrippa said to Paul, and there's about 8 gazillion interpretations of what he says here. Does he mean, and in Greek it's just very ambiguous. Does he mean, wow, I'm on the verge of becoming a Christian? Does he mean, you think you're going to turn me into a Christian that quickly? And a gazillion variations to that effect. But Paul doesn't get deterred. Verse 29, Paul said, whether short or long, I would to God that not only you, but all who hear me this day might become such as I am, except for these chains. Now, here's the other point I want to make before we run out of time tonight. I don't think there's any question that Agrippa knows that Paul is telling the truth based on what Paul says here. I don't think Paul would have put himself out there like that if he didn't know that Agrippa knows the truth here. But Agrippa does not become a Christian. Take the best case scenario, maybe he's close. Worst case scenario, he's flippant and obnoxious. And you pick, and you know, options in between. But what this reminds us is that belief is not just an intellectual act. Belief is also an act of the will. There can be things that you know are true, but you don't trust in and follow through on because you don't want to. You just don't want to. You know, how many people, honestly, and if you have a nicotine addiction, trust me, I'm not trying to be flippant toward you. My mom smoked and was addicted for years, and I don't know how she managed to get off of it, but I mean, my heart goes out to anybody. It is a terrible addiction, all right? So I'm not trying to be flippant. But how many people don't know smoking is terrible for your health? Everybody knows that. But they're just going to smoke anyway because they want to. And I think this is something that at first it frustrates us, but then it centers us. We just have to realize there are times when you teach the gospel to somebody and they don't respond and you think, oh, we did something wrong. No. No. You're going to tell me all those people Jesus taught that were screaming for him to be put to death, he did something wrong? That's not the issue here. And that's the part of conversion and preaching the gospel we just have to remember is that we can do the very best that we can to teach the truth. But there's also an element of the will that is involved where a person has to choose to respond on what they know. Tommy, you get the last word. You better make it good here. Could he have withdrawn his appeal? I would imagine so. I don't know enough about what the law was like. But maybe you're thinking, like, if Agrippa had said, hey, you know what? We should just throw this thing out. Could he have backed off? Maybe so. Maybe so. Yeah. Uh-oh. Mickey's wants the last word, Tommy. Sorry.
I just want to say that God had told
him
that he wasn't
wrong. Yeah, nobody's questioning that. The issue is, would he go on an appeal to Caesar or go freely? My guess is when Paul first said, the Spirit wants me to go to Rome, he thought it would be free. It's going to turn out he's going to go as a prisoner.
But if he'd have went as a free man, he would have got killed all the way.
Well, maybe so. Maybe so. I mean, you can't prove that, and I can't prove you're wrong. So...